Okay, Boker Tov, everyone. Cholam Azinim is actually at Frisch this morning for a Ksiva Sefer Torah. This web has donated a Sefer Torah to the school, so I had to leave early to come here, but Mazel Tov to them. So entitle this, The Musar of Megillas Esther. What moral lessons did Chazal extract from Megillah itself that, in fact, are meaningful to all of us? So you have a handout here. I found four things, some of them famous, some of them less famous, but let's start with number one. At the end of Perek Beis, Bayamim Ahem, Mordechai Yoshev B'Shar HaMelech. In those days, Mordechai is sitting in the king's gate. I mean, it's part of the king's retinue. I don't think he necessarily had a very high position, but nonetheless, he had a position. Kotzaf big son Vaseresh, Shnei Sari Sehamelech, Mishamre Asaf. So two of the king's closer, more intimate advisors, big son and Seresh, they became incensed at the king, Vaivakshu Lashloach Yad Bamelech HaHashverosh, and they endeavored to strike against the king, assassinate the king. Vayivada Hadavar LeMordechai, and Mordechai found out about it, it was made known to him. How did he find out? What's that? No, Chazal say they spoke exotic languages, Big Son and Seresh, and Mordechai, being a member of the Sanhedrin, had to be fluent in 70 languages, so they thought they were talking privately, their own tongue that no one else would understand, but he was able to understand. Vayaged l'Ester Malka, and he related this to Esther, what the plot. Vatomer Esther LaMelech B'Shem Mordechai, and Esther told the king in the name of Mordechai. It's a little vignette at the end of Perek Beis. Of course, it plays a big role later in the Megillah. In Perek Vav, Balayla Hahu Nodadosh Shnas HaMelech, king couldn't sleep. He also sensed something was awry because the queen had invited him twice to ask him something and brought Haman in as well. Esther was playing with his mind and couldn't sleep. He wanted to find out, was there ever anyone who did a favor for the king that was not compensated, not rewarded? And in fact, that's how this story was uncovered of Big Son and Seresh. So Gemara says in Megillah, Elber Rabbi Elazar, Amar Rabbi Chanina, Kol Omer Dova B'Shem Omro, Mevi Geula Le'olam. Anyone who relates something in someone else's name brings redemption to the world. All right? How do we know this? Dichsiv. Tomer Esther LaMelech B'Shem Mordechai. Esther told the king in the name of Mordechai, and everything else came together, everything spiraled because of that one incident. It's not just that Esther told the king. He would have been grateful to her. She was, after all, the queen. Wouldn't have gone any further than that. But he was great. But Esther told the king B'Shem Mordechai, mentioning Mordechai's name, and that, of course, became part of the official annals as well. So the Gemara says, it's Tesvav Amar Alfi Megillah, Kol HaOmer Davar B'Shem Omro, Mevi Geula LeOlam. All right, as someone once asked me many years ago, yes, it did happen here, but why would we generalize from the one case? I mean, where else do we see that such a thing has happened? Why is this such an overwhelming principle, or universally applicable principle, that we would apply generally? I'm sure there are other cases, but just because it happened here, how could Chazal say Kol HaOmer Davar B'Shem Omro? If you just quote someone to someone else, that's going to bring redemption to the world. Why should that be? Now, this Gemara is quoted actually in a Mishnah, or vice versa. The Gemara quotes the Mishnah in the sixth parak of Avos, the parak of Kinyan Torah. That's in number three. There the Mishnah says, actually, Braisa, Gedola Torah Yosem and Akahunim and Amalchus. Torah is greater than even the priesthood or royalty. Shahamalchus Niknes B'Shloshimalos. Royalty is acquired through 30 different traits. The Hakahuna Be'esim V'Arba. Kahuna is acquired with 24, through 24. Vatara Niknes Ba'arba'im U'Shmona Dvarim. But the Torah is acquired in 48 different ways. 48 different qualities that a person has to have. And the Mishnah, the Brisa lists all of them. First, Talmud, you have to study, Shmias Ozen, listen, you have to articulate well, Binas Alev, etc., all the way to the very end. What's the 48th quality? Ha'omer Dover B'Shem Omro. A person who says something in the name of another, meaning if you are quoting someone, you can't try to pass it off as your own. Rather, you have to cite it in the name of the person from whom you learned it. Holamanato shekol omer davar b'shem omro mevi geula l'olam. So from this we see that anyone who says something in the name of another brings redemption to the world. Shenemar v'tomer Esther l'melech b'shem Mordechai. So not only do we have this general principle brought in the context of the story, it is actually more universally applied in terms of Talmud Torah. If a person wants to acquire Torah, this is the one of the qualities that's necessary. And not only that, it's the 48th. It's the last. It's the one that brings it all together. And the question is, why would that be? Yes?
My question is, what do they mean by Geula
L'Olam? That's also a question. What does it mean, maybe Geula L'Olam?
Because these things that happen, so we haven't had, but I consider it to be Geula.
Yes, I said this right before you came in.
Oh, okay.
That's all right. I'm thinking along your lines. The fact is, the first question I raised was, how do you universalize this? It's one particular case. So in this instance, it brought Geula to the world. But that doesn't mean every case is going to. How could you prove that in such a way that Chazal would articulate it in such a categorical way? Where do we see proof of that? Lolam is to the world. I mean, it really means the Jewish world, but could be the world generally. Now, the Tor Tamima asks this very question also. Funny, he didn't cite it in your name, but all right. It's just the calendar was held against you. That's all, the clock. But he asks the question. He quotes the Rif. The Rif says that it means a person who quotes someone, who cites accurately the source of his teaching, that person is, good things will come from that. Good things will come from that. Generally, because it's a function of honesty, integrity, right? Often do we hear that people plagiarize. They write things, they pass it off on as their own. Sometimes, I don't want to mention any names, but there's a certain American vice president who basically took someone else's biography, made it his own. But nonetheless, it's very common. There's ego involved, there's a lack of integrity. So a person who's very careful to cite his knowledge, his statement, in the name of the one who said it, that from that integrity, good things happen. And the Rif says it's just in this particular context it brought salvation. But in other contexts, it might not bring salvation, but it'll bring other good outcomes. There's always a benefit to honesty, right? We tell our children, honesty pays. What's the slogan? Honesty is the best policy. How could I forget that, huh? Honesty is the best policy. Well, all right, that's what the Rif says. The Tor Tamima quotes it, but Rav Kook, Rav Tzvi Yehuda Kook, has a very interesting approach, and he questions, oh, thank you, it's my bookmark. Thank you very much. See, he asks that why is this the last of the midos, the last of the Arba'im u'shmon advarim, the last of the qualities through which we acquire Torah. By the way, so we've been learning that for years already on Shavuos in the evenings. I think we're towards the end, if not maybe finished altogether, I don't remember. But when we speak of Kinyan Torah, it means there are 48 attributes, 48 characteristics that comprise the Torah personality. And if we're lacking one of them, it's going to render deficient our ability to understand and carry out the Torah as well. So we need all 48 qualities, but Rav Kook says the last one mentioned is this one. Ha'omer davar b'shem omro. The one who quotes something in someone else's name. And explains as follows. You see, the Chazal were very meticulous, almost to the point of obsessiveness in getting names right. If you look at the Gemara, every statement in the Gemara is sourced, and if there's sometimes multiply sourced, Omer Rav Yochanan Amar Rav, Omer Rav Yehuda Amar Shmuel, Rabbi Yochanan said in Rav's name, Rav Yehuda said in Shmuel's name, etc., etc. Sometimes you'll find multiple sources, Va'amri Law, that X quoted Y, but some say it was really A quoting B. Sometimes it'll go for two or three lines just to get the sourcing, the attribution accurate. He says that this is really the climax of Kinyan Torah, not in terms of honesty, which is obviously true, but even one of the Midos mentioned earlier, but something else. A person, if you say something b'shem Omro, if you cite something in the name of the original source, in terms of Torah, what you're doing then is relating everything backwards. And ultimately, Omer Dova b'shem Omro goes back to the original Omer. Who's the original Omer? Moshe Rabbeinu. Kol Omer Dova b'shem Omro means that if you say something and then you make it part of the Mesorah, then that means its original source becomes Vaydaber Hashem el Moshe Lemar. And then you know that you have been Kona Torah. And he goes on to say that's really the climax of Kinyan Torah, Siyasiyim, when the apex of apexes, when the Shmua, the teaching, becomes part of the Torah. So then a person who says something is not just an isolated scholar who may or may not be brilliant or innovative, but rather he's part of the shalshelet, the part of the chain of the Jewish people, and therefore it's not an individual's Talmud Torah anymore, rather it's the Talmud Torah of the Klal. Now, if that's the case, why does it bring Geula? Why does it bring redemption? So he explains that Talmud Torah, when a person studies Torah, it doesn't just result in personal growth, which of course is very valuable, but it's also an encounter with historic Israel. It's not just something that we're doing for ourselves, but what he calls Zob Pekisha Im Kol Tokpa Shel Torah. It's an encounter with all the force, all the authority, all the weight, all the historicity of Torah. When we learn Torah, it's not just we're indulging in a pleasurable activity that's going to benefit us, but rather we're linking ourselves through the chain of generations back to Sinai. So a person who does that, it's not just an individual act of greatness, but rather he becomes part of the generations of Jews. So now we understand, Kol Omer Dover B'Shem Omro, you think it's just an individual act. When a person does something that's decent, that's honest, that's faithful, it is an individual act. But you see, it has greater consequences than just the individual act. It becomes part of a national consciousness, and there's a ripple effect. Every small act, small good act, I guess even small bad acts, have ripple effects. It affects others within our vicinity, beyond our vicinity. Even people that we don't know can be affected by things that we do or say. So therefore, Kol Omer Dover B'Shem Omro, you think it's just a small act of integrity, that you didn't try to pass off something as your own that really was someone else's. But it's much more than that, because you link yourself into a greater scheme, and that's Mevi Geula La'olam. It brings redemption to the world. Redemption in the context of Talmud Torah means it's a validation, of the whole purpose of Torah. The purpose of Torah being the implementation of the Ratzon Hashem on earth. And if a person does that, the small act of honesty, that in fact results in great things, because it validates, it legitimizes the Ratzon Hashem on earth. That's this memra. It's a very beautiful memra. We say in Pirkei Avos over the summer, because it's in the sixth parak, and it's very famous, and the context is Mordechai and Esther. But nonetheless, you see in that context what it brought. In the context of Talmud Torah, it's the exact same thing. It's the small act that's going to have ramifications even beyond what the person realizes at the time. Okay, next, number four. So, we all know the story. The third parak of the Megillah, Haman decides to kill the Jews. Haman is Amaleki, descendant of Agog. He decides to kill the, exterminate all the Jews. Goes to the king, makes the king an offer. Basically, he will fill the coffers of the king's treasury with the thousands of talents of silver in exchange for the right to excise one of the king's 127 different ethnicities that made up his kingdom. And the king agrees. He doesn't really seem to ask too many questions once he knew the money was coming. And then he seals the deal. Number four, Vayosar HaMelech es tabato me'al yado, Vayetnole Haman ben Hamdoso Hagagi Tzorer Hayudim. The king removed his signet ring from his hand, and he gave it to Haman ben Hamdoso Hagagi, descendant of Agag, the king of Amalek, who was slain by Shmuel Hanavi. It's this Shabbos Haftarah. Tzorer Hayudim, the tormentor of the Jews. It's interesting, by the way, that this entire pedigree of Haman is listed again. It's not the first time it's listed in the context of the Pasuk. You know, we're not being introduced to Haman here. We knew already Haman from the beginning of the Perek, and yet we have all these references to Haman. So why that is, we'll get to in a moment. But what does the Gemara say here? It's Megillah Daf Yud Dalet Amud Aleph. Vayasar HaMelech Es Tabato. The king took off his ring. Om Rabbi Abba Bar Kahana. Gedola Hasaras Tabaas Yoser Me'arboim U'shmona Nevi'im V'sheva Nevi'os Shenisnabu Lehen L'Yisrael. The king taking off his ring had a greater effect on Jews than all the words of the 48 prophets and the 7 prophetesses who prophesied for Israel. Shekulon lo hechzirim lemutav. None of the prophets or prophetesses succeeded in returning the Jews to the good, meaning permanently, right? A drush is good in its time, but who remembers it Sunday morning? Ve'ilu hasaras hatabas hechziratan lemutav. But all the king had to do was take off his ring, give it to Haman, and then right away the Jews were crying, and the tshuva, and everything unfolded. So why should that be? Why is it that the hasaras hatabas, the king taking off his ring, meaning that one act, had a greater effect on Jews than anything else, all the words of the prophets, and I'll tell you something else, seems to have had a greater effect on the Jews than the very decree of Haman and Ahasuerus? Because the decree was the decree, but the Gemara doesn't say that the decree was worse, meaning the threat of the enemy was worse than the worst of all. What was worse than the threat or the publicizing of the decree was the publication of the decree was the king's removing his ring. Why should that be worse than the threat itself? So first, the Marsha says here that when Ahasuerus gave his ring to Haman, meaning the ring with the king's seal and everything is finished, so then the Jews realized there was no longer any political option that they had. All right, Umar says here too that Haman knew that Ahasuerus was a hafachfach. He was impetuous. He was impulsive, meaning lafoch. He would very quickly change his mind. More than malleable, he was. What's that? That's correct. He was very easily influenced. Very easily influenced. And people like that. They're influenced by the last person they speak to. Ahasuerus was like that too. But Haman knew the laws of the kingdom. One of the regs was that if the king seals something, then it can't be reversed. In fact, that's part of the story. That even after Haman was killed on Pesach already, and the decree was not to be carried out for another 13 months or so, they knew that they could not revoke the king's decree because the king could never be wrong. It's a good policy, by the way. The king could never... That's Putin's policy. It's Putin's policy these days. King can never be wrong. So what he did was not revoke the decree, but he supplemented the decree with another decree that the Jews can defend themselves, which is not something completely different. But so Haman knew once he had the ring that it means this was going forward and could not be turned back at all. Once the Jews heard that Ahasuerus had given over his ring to Haman, then they knew that they did not have a political approach to the situation, because it was more than Haman. Now the king was invested in their demise as well, and therefore they could that option was already closed off. So that's why it's worse than the Gezerah. In other words, the Marsha says, if it's just the Gezerah, so you have Shtadlonim, you have different approaches, you start to appeal, you start to lobby, you demonstrate all over the world, whatever it is. You try to have the decree revoked, but once the king's seal is on it, then it can't be revoked anymore, and therefore that's Gedola Hasaras HaTabas. But why is it greater than the words of the Nevi'im? Why don't the words of the Nevi'im work? See, here we come to a very interesting phenomenon that I think we all recognize on some level. It's why an Eis Tzara is always a greater time for tefillah, more opportune time for tefillah than normal existence. It's very hard for people to summon up, you know, on an average day, the type of passion or sincerity that's necessary. The bottom line is that words themselves, even the very striking and sometimes fearsome words of the prophets, you know, the Nevi'im generally gave tochacha, reproof to the people. But even their words have a limited effect. A limited effect. It's really only a surface effect. It's the threat of death, of extermination, that gets people's attention much better. And this was illustrated, a famous quote from Samuel Johnson, the Brit, who said that when a man knows he's to be hanged in a fortnight, it concentrates his mind. That's what he said. That's really what the Gemara is saying here. What's the pshat? It means that nevuah is a given, nevuah is appreciated, the words of the Nevi'im are appreciated as well, but they don't always penetrate the surface. It sounds good, it sounds right, but it doesn't always change the heart. Maybe it can modify behavior for a short time, but it doesn't necessarily penetrate to the roots of the individual. But faced with mortality, people have a different perspective then on what life is, on what's real, on what's valuable in life, on what's meaningful in life. And that's what it means, Gedola Hasaras Tabas. The Nevi'im could predict and prophesy that the Churban is coming, that war is coming, like in Thomas and Chayrev, and if you don't do tshuva, there are going to be dire consequences. Until the enemy appears, it's hard for people to accept that. And it's a pattern that recurs. I think the earliest time in our history we had that was with Noach. Noach. People did not believe a word that Noach was saying. Even when it started to rain, they didn't believe what Noach was saying. It's only when it became dire that they started to believe. Noach, then it was too late. But it's a very human approach to life. Until there's cherev chada al tzavar shel adam, until there's a sharp knife at our throats, sharp sword at our throats, to be accurate, it doesn't engender the same type of response as it should. When a person feels mortality, like the Jews felt here, then tshuva becomes a very realistic option, because it just seems to be a more substantive, significant part of a person's life. Whatever a person does, you know, whatever enjoyments, leisure a person has, whatever work a person does, it really doesn't matter when you're contemplating the ultimate, right? There's a saying, I sent bumper sticker, no one ever died regretting he didn't spend as much time in the office as he could have. It's true. You want to then focus on what's more meaningful in life. And what's meaningful in life is our Avodas Hashem, chesed that we do, the family, children, grandchildren, etc. That's what's most meaningful. So it's the hasaras hatabas. It seems, you know, almost unfortunate that it has to be that way, that you need that stark recognition of mortality to bring us around. But that's what Chazal say, that sadly is the reality of life. And we know that it continues once the tabas is gone, that once the immediate threat is gone, we revert to our prior condition pretty quickly. It'll linger for time. Maybe some of it will penetrate a little more, but to have a complete transformation is very, very difficult. It only leaves it up to the only yechidim are really capable of making those transformations in their lives based on situations that arise. It does happen, by the way. I mean, I've met people whose lives are transformed, Bali Tshuva, who just because of a certain trauma or something's even a certain positive experience that completely turned around and they accepted it. And they're very happy they did. But those are really yechidim. Most people are in the category of what Rav Abba Bar Kahana notes here. So one other point, why does the Megillah say Haman's entire background? So here Rav Avinir mentions in his commentary on the Haggadah that it's because we should remember always that at the end of the day, it was Haman's hatred for the Jews that was the primary force here. That was the prime mover. That was the catalyst. And very often we're critical of ourselves, sometimes rightfully so, and we bring on ourselves different sorrows. And there's no doubt the Jews, Chazal criticized the Jews here also, assimilating, they went to the banquet of Achashverosh, in which he brought out the kalim of the Beis HaMikdash, and still the Jews partied with everybody else. There's no doubt we had a share in the calamity, but nonetheless, nothing we did was deserving of the calamity. The calamity came about because of Haman. God could have punished us in a different way because of our sins. It was Haman's hatred and nothing else that the Jews did. And he notes, agavurcha, but it's true, because we see this week after week, no matter how good Jews are, even Eretz Yisrael, no matter how people try to act civilized and how they try to impute good motives to our enemies, it always comes back to haunt us. At the end of the day, it's Haman ben Hamdasa ha'agagi tzorer ha'yudim. The bottom line is tzorer ha'yudim. Someone is a tzorer ha'yudim, a tormentor of Jews. It's like an occupation. The people in the world have a business card that says on it tzorer ha'yudim. And if that's the case, there's nothing we can do that's going to change that. We just have to fight back. Yes.
So the hatred preceded Mordechai's not bowing down to him.
Long
that
before.
That was a catalyst, just an excuse. To make everything
That's correct. It's interesting, Rav Avinir notes in that context that 1938, before Kristallnacht, so this fellow, Herschel Greenspan, killed a German, I think his name was von Rath. He was the third secretary at the embassy in Paris. He killed him. He tried to kill the ambassador. He didn't get to him, so he killed a low-level diplomat. And Kristallnacht came about as a result. Thousands of Jews were killed. Hundreds of Jews were killed. Thousands were sent to concentration camps, etc. But it's not as if Greenspan was the cause. He was killed right away anyway. It's not as if he was the cause of it. The Nazis were looking for a pretext to kill Jews. So they just waited for the pretext. It could have been a Jew shoplifting. Didn't have to be this one act in Paris. That's the definition of Tzorer HaYudim. There's nothing that a Jew does that makes someone into Tzorer HaYudim. He is a Tzorer HaYudim. He may sometimes wait for a pretext. He may sometimes not wait for a pretext. But nonetheless, what's the proof? If the fact that Mordechai did not bow down to Haman is not rationally a reason why you would therefore exterminate all of his people. That's not a rational reason. But it doesn't have to be rational. That's the definition of Tzorer HaYudim, and that's the lima to us. Of course, we have to try to be good for its own sake, not because it engenders good feelings amongst our fellow citizens. In its own sake, it's right to do. But nonetheless, one should never think that the idea that we bring these things on ourselves, it's trite. You can't bring anything on yourself that a Tzorer HaYudim will not be able to take advantage of. Okay, next, a very interesting medrash. So number six, the story continues. Mordechai yodas kol asher na'asah. Mordechai knew everything that had happened, that had unfolded in the palace. Vayikra Mordechai's bigadov, he tore his garments. Vayelbash sak va'efer, and he dressed himself in sackcloth and ashes. I don't know, where do they sell sackcloth and ashes today? Seems to have been common only in biblical times. Vayelbash sak va'efer. Vayetze v'sochayir, he went out into the city. Vayizak z'akogedolo umara, and he cried a great and bitter cry. Okay. Look at the Medrash number 7. It's in the beginning of Parsha Ches in the Esther Rabbah. Mordechai yadas kol asher nasa vayikra Mordechai's bigadov. He tore his garments. Binyamin garam l'shvatim likara, or likroa should be. Binyamin caused his brothers to tear their garments. What's the context? So remember, Binyamin and his brothers are before Yosef. Yosef slips his goblet into Binyamin's sack. After the brothers deny any knowledge of the disappearance of Yosef's goblet, they found the goblet in Binyamin's sack, and the brothers tore their clothing. Vehechan garmalo kriya. Where then did this act of Binyamin, this passive act really, of causing his brother's garments to be torn, where was that recompensed? Bishushan Abira. Hadahu dichsiv, vayikra Mordechai's bigadov, v'hu ish yimini. Mordechai tore his own garments, and Mordechai, of course, was a descendant of Binyamin. So Binyamin caused his brothers to have to tear their garments in the story of Yosef and his brothers. Eventually, Ben Binyamin had to tear his own garments, and that would be Mordechai. All right, simple question we could ask ourselves. What in the world does this mean? What does it mean that because Binyamin caused the brothers to tear their garments, so therefore Mordechai now has to tear his garments? Ask a better question. What would Binyamin cause? He wasn't at fault. It's not as if he put the goblet there. He was as innocent as the rest of them. So why would the Medrash attribute to Binyamin? Binyamin garam l'shvatim l'kroa. He caused them to have to tear. He didn't cause them. That was their natural response to the tragedy unfolding before them, that they couldn't believe what was happening. So what did he do? Just to go on, you'll see the same idea in the next paragraph. Vayizak ze'akah gedolo umara. Mordechai screamed this great and bitter scream. Vehechan nifralo, where was that paid back? Bishushan. Shenemar vayizak ze'akah gedolo umara. What are we talking about? All right, Am Rabbi Chanan. Maidichsiv. Mandamar. Strike that. Manda Omar, Kutcha Brichu Vatranhu. Anyone who says that Kadosh Baruch Hu is a Vatran means he overlooks things, Mivater. Yivatrun Bnei Meohi, his intestines should be overlooked, meaning they should melt. Elamarich Ruche Vigove Delay. That God is Marich Ruach, Erech Hapayim, he's very patient, but eventually collects from everyone. Teda, Shaharei Ze'aka Achas Hizik Yaakov Le'esav. Yaakov caused Esav to cry one bitter cry as well. That's the pasuk in Parshas Toldos. Tichsiv Vayitzak Ze'aka Gedola Umora Ad Ma'od. What's the context? We all remember the context. Yaakov is able to steal the brachos from Esav. His father blesses him. Yaakov's heading out. Esav's coming in. They realize what's happened. Esav is without the deprived of the bracha of his father, material bounty. Vayitzak tzaka gedola umara ad ma'od. Esav unleashes a fierce, bitter, and powerful cry, ad ma'od. Ad ma'od means intensity, length, and I think permanence, the long cry. So Medrash says, when did we pay for his crying? Now. It's almost the same words. Mordechai cried that loud and bitter cry as a parallel to what Esav did. Well, I have to ask on this as well. Esav was a Rasha, right? Yaakov Avinu, at the end of the day, was just following his mother's advice, right? He took his mother's advice, but it's not as if Binyamin was completely innocent. Esav's not innocent. Esav, he was already named Esav HaRasha by that point. That was his last name. So why would we batter ourselves? Why should we even be punished at all? Why should Esav's cry require any type of compensation, any type of recompense, because of what happened so many centuries earlier? It's a very interesting point. Now, I'll mention two things that in the Medrash HaMevu'ar, he quotes two sources. Not the pshat, but nonetheless interesting. First, on the first one, was Binyamin at fault at all? So there's some Mefarshim say, yes, he was partially at fault. Partially at fault. Yeah, a small amount of fault. Why? Because he knew what had happened when the brothers came back the first time and they found the money that they had paid in their sacks. And when they saw that, they panicked. Their father panicked even more because he knew it was strange. It looked like they stole it, all right? So at the very least, Binyamin should have checked his sack to make sure that nothing was in there. He's partially at fault. But Rabbi Yonasan Eibeshitz in the Aris Dvash has an interesting approach, and he says that in the story of Yosef and Binyamin, that Yosef privately took Binyamin aside and revealed himself to Binyamin before they had this whole charade with the goblet, but he told him that he wants the brothers to earn their kapara this way, by testing them to see their response. But Binyamin stood by while he witnessed his brothers' anguish. And for that, he deserved to have garments torn as well. Continuing the story, the pasuk says, "Umordechai yoda eskal asher nasa." Mordechai knew past tense. What did he know? So he says also, prophetically, Mordechai knew what would happen. And he knew that the Jews would be saved as well, but nonetheless he wanted to use the occasion in order to induce tshuva in the Jewish people. But nonetheless, he caused Jews to panic, to be frightened, to cry, just like Yosef did with Binyamin. So therefore, that's the fault. I don't think that's the pshat, either in the story of Yosef and his brothers, or here as well. But there's a different pshat. Something that we realize, maybe not as much as we should, but we do realize it. The words of the Medrash are very powerful. Whoever says, Manda Omar, Kutra Brichu Vatranhu, Yavatran B'nei Mohi, a person who thinks that God overlooks things, it's false. There's a Midah Keneged Midah in the world. The scales of justice are always completely balanced. What, of course, is very upsetting to us is that we never know. We can't know how or why it is. We just know that it is. So here we look at little Binyamin as an innocent. But what did the innocent do? Nothing. He really wasn't innocent. But indirectly, he caused anguish to people. Indirectly. He was a tool that was used in order to make other people afraid, regretful, mournful, apologetic, whatever it is. But he was the tool to cause suffering to a human being. That itself is something that requires kapara. Even if he's completely innocent, it requires kapara. The analogy would be, I guess, the case of Shar Niskal, or really any case of an animal. Let's say an animal kills someone, all right? An animal's an animal, all right? Or, Rahman al-San, bestiality. The animal's also killed, not just the human being. What did the animal do? He's not a bardas. So people shouldn't say, this animal killed, you know, Joe, Bob. This animal. Have an animal walk around who killed a human being. So we want the vehicle of tragedy, of calamity, removed from us. Just like we want the vehicle for sin removed from us as well. See, an animal who was forced into sin with a perverted human being, So of course the human beings are fooled, but nonetheless it's a busha to have the animal around. So that's mida keneged mida. The same thing here with Binyamin ben Yaakov as well. Anyone who even indirectly would cause pain to another, so needs to be rectified. It needs to be recompensed, if only for the individual. We shouldn't allow ourselves, even unwillingly, even unwittingly, to be used as the tools to cause harm to other human beings. And that applies to Esav also. So Binyamin really was an innocent. Esav wasn't such an innocent. But nonetheless, I think the point of the Medrash here is not just Vayitzak Tzakagadolo Umara, but Ad Ma'od. And the Bali Musar say in a number of contexts about this, these areas, that here, take the classic one that the Alter said. When Esav confronted his brother Yaakov, so he saw, he was greeted by the Yaakov and his sons, wives and sons, but one person was not there. Who was not there? Dina. All right? V'dina hechon haisa, Chazal asked. Where was Dina? So the Chazal answered that Dina, Yaakov hid her in a box. So Esav shouldn't look at her, want to marry her. And Esav said, all right, you know, we'll let bygones be bygones. Take your daughter. That's the way a sulcha is arranged in the Middle East. Take your daughter. All is finished. He hid her, all right? Was he right in hiding her? Yes. But the Bali Musar said, when he closed the box, he gave the box an extra clop, all right? As a, like, as a little satisfaction that he pulled this one on Esav. That type of satisfaction. So Chazal say, that's why he had his own problems with Dina, literally, when she got out of the box, all right? Vateitse Dina. That type of smugness is a character flaw, and every character flaw that we have is eventually finds its outlet, and really it's kapar as well, because life is an ongoing process of growth, improvement. So it's the same thing here. Maybe Yaakov, when Esav cried Ad Ma'od, maybe Yaakov took a little too much satisfaction in it. That in fact he was a reluctant participant in the charade, but nonetheless it brought it made Esav even more sad, more angry than he otherwise should have been, and that's what needed the recompense here, and we pay for that. Vayizag ze'akogadala umara. One other point I would add, very fine book, I hope is out this summer, my next book on the Jewish ethic of personal responsibility. So even Esav is wrong, right? Esav is wrong. There's no question. He's a Rasha. But Yaakov could not get into the habit of using harsh methods that cause pain to others, even if unjustified, because that becomes a flaw in Klal Yisrael. And we see something else. When Esav cried so bitterly, why was he crying? Because effectively, and this is what I write in the book, effectively, he was written out of Klal Yisrael. He's not part of the family of Avram anymore. He's gone. Yitzhak tried to keep him in the fold, but this really was the final severance. He was no longer in the fold, and he realized that, and that's the bitterness of his cry. But whenever we lose a Jewish child, we eventually cry for it. It eventually comes back to haunt us. We pay a price for every Jewish child that's lost. And in Esav's case, what was the price that we paid? Who's Esav's grandson? Amalek, Eliphaz's son. We pay a price for that. And that's the mida keneged mida here. Vayizag ze'akah gadolo umara. Here in Shushan with Mordechai versus the Vayitzak Tzakah Gedolo Umara Ad Ma'od of Esav with Yaakov and Yitzhak. We always pay a price for it, and that's the linkage that the Medrash is making here. Okay, finally, one of the most famous of the Musar statements that really needs to be understood properly. It's the very last pasuk in the Megillah. Just to fill in the blanks, you know, we're saved. We're jumping from Perek Dalet to Perek Yud. But you should know, shouldn't be in suspense, Jewish people were saved during the story. Ki Mordechai ha-Yehudi mishne la-melech ha-Chashverosh. Mordechai now became the adjunct to the king. the Gadol Ayhudim, he's great of the Jews. Ratzui Rovechov, he's desirable, pleasing to most of his brethren. Deresh Tov La'amo, he seeks good for his nation. Dover Shalom L'chol Zaro, speaks peaceably for all his descendants. What stands out? It's high praise. Gadol Ayhudim, Deresh Tov La'amo, Dover Shalom L'chol Zaro. What stands out? Ratzui L'rovechov. Most, but not all. All right? Not everybody. You can't please everyone. Every Jewish leader should know this. You can't please everyone. Mordechai only saved the Jewish people from extermination, but not everyone was happy about it. What have you done for us lately? Okay, it's now a few weeks past that. It's the end of the Megillah. Gemara says here in Megillah, Daf Tezayin Amud Beis, Ki Mordechai Hayudi Mishneh LaMelech HaSherosh V'Gadol Hayudim V'Ratzui L'Rovechov L'Rovechov V'Lo L'Cholechov. To most of his brethren, not all of his brethren, Milamed Shepershu Mimenu Miktzas Sanhedrin. Mordechai had been on the Sanhedrin, and now some of his colleagues on the Sanhedrin distance themselves from him because of his new position. Rashi says he was Mishneh LaMelech Lifisha Batal Minatora V'Nichnas L'Srara. All right? He stopped learning as much as he did before. He went into governance. He was part of the ruling class, no longer a colleague on the Sanhedrin, so they kept their distance from him. In other words, Mordechai, Mati, you've saved us. Now come back to the Sanhedrin with us. Come back and learn. Come back to the Beis Medrash. All right? Seems, it's actually pretty common phenomenon. But why should that be? Ratzui L'Rovechov, show some gratitude. It should be eternal gratitude for what Mordechai and Esther did, not just this half-heartedness. So why would that be? So I think, from one perspective, it's an important commentary. The Sanhedrin cannot be political. Politicians have to compromise. Politicians can't always get what they want. And they have to get their hands dirty as well. If a Rav, for that matter, a Dayan, a member of the Sanhedrin, is seen as too close to the political class, so inevitably they become splattered with the same mud in which the political class is often forced to wallow. You see, Rachman al-Tan in Israel today, the number of Rabbanim are being investigated, some already indicted for bribes, for influence peddling, etc. You can't mix those worlds. And the Sanhedrin realized that they had to keep far from Mordechai. Some distance between them and Mordechai. Because being Mishneh LaMelech HaSherosh undoubtedly would require Mordechai to do things of which they would not approve. They didn't want to say, Mordechai in power, he's like, it's like one on the Sanhedrin being in power, because there's certain expectations that are there that could not necessarily be met. So the Sanhedrin really had to stay apart from Mordechai on that basis alone. But there's something else as well. It's very interesting, and it caused me to sit up for a moment last night when I looked this over. Omer of Yosef, Gadol Talmud Torah, Yosef Matzos Nefashos. Learning Torah is greater than saving lives. How do we know this? D'meikara choshelei l'mordechai basa arba'o, ulvasov basa chamisha. The context is as follows. Mordechai came to Israel with Zerubbabel, all right? But his arrival is listed twice, recorded twice. Once in Sefer Ezra, once in Sefer Nehemiah. So if you just go down, Meikara ksiv, before Mordechai became the Mishneh LaMelech, what was the order of arrival? Here's the pasuk in Ezra. Asher bo im Zerubbabel, Yeshua, Nehemiah, Saraya, Ra'alia, Mordechai Bilshon. He's mentioned after the fourth, meaning he's the fifth in line. Ulvasof, after he became Mishneh LaMelech, it's Habam im Zerubbabel, Yeshua, Nehemiah, Azariah, Ra'amiah, Nachmani, Mordechai Bilshon. He's the sixth mentioned. He is has knocked down a peg on the hierarchy. When he was involved in Torah, he had a higher status. would involve just Hatzalas Nefashos, he had a lower status. So I'll ask you a question. What in the world does this mean? Gedola Talmud Torah Yosir Hatzalas Nefashos. I mean, I think there was a whole rally yesterday that was devoted to this entire idea. Yes! Talmud Torah is greater than Hatzalas Nefashos. So the Haredim, right? You say they're right.
I don't say they're right. No.
What about the Gemara?
A very good point.
You mean the Gemara has a good point? Based on this Gemara?
Yes.
Okay, I was afraid you'd say that. I set you up for that, by the way. Yeah, they're right. Unless they try to understand what Chazal is saying here. If they understand what the Chazal is saying, then you see why they're not right. Of course, if you took it literally, that would mean to say if a guy is sitting over Gemara and he sees someone drowning, he can keep learning rather than save him. So that can't be the pshat. What's the pshat then? I think it's something that we're all familiar with because it's such a widespread phenomenon in Jewish life. There are many Jews, and dozens, literally dozens of Jewish organizations that deal with the protection of Jewish life, with combating Jew hatred, etc. You know, I said for many years, America has far too many of these organizations because the level of Jew hatred in America is almost non-existent. But nonetheless, close to, if not more than $1 billion a year is spent trying to protect Jewish life in America. What's the real danger in America? Assimilation. That's the danger. That's what's costing us Jewish life. It's the threat to Jews in America is primarily spiritual, not physical. It's not like it was in Europe. It's a spiritual threat. So all these organizations save Jews. By the way, some of them are staffed by Jews or intermarried, or even non-Jews, the children of intermarried Jews. They're saving Jews, but for what purpose? And that's the question. I've had these discussions with people over the years, and I can be caustic at times. I would say, you're saving Jews, great. Why? Tell me why it's important to save Jews. Why? What's the difference? What does it matter to the world whether there are Jews or not in existence? And I've said to people, leaders, why does it matter to you whether Jews exist? Oh, I'm Jewish. Yeah, but why does it matter to you? If your child, your grandchild is not Jewish, so what are we saving Jews for? It's not simply that a Jew, a descendant of Avram, should live. It's rather that we have a purpose in existence. The Jewish people have a purpose in existence that transcends mere survival. I tell you, to my regret, I have never heard a good answer from someone within these organizations as not whether should Jews exist, but why should Jews exist? They don't have an answer to that because they don't have the background for that.
They don't say to study Torah?
No, not in the least. They're not religious. Most are not religious. So my point is, I think this is what Chazal is saying. Gedola Torah, Gedola Talmud Torah, Yosef Me'atzos Nefashos. Talmud Torah here means the reason why Jews live. To serve HaKadosh Baruch Hu, to bring the ideas of God to the world, to bring the values of God to the world, to live in the way that reflects His will on earth. It's not, what Chazal is saying, it's not enough to keep Jews alive. It's more important to keep alive the purpose for which Jews should live. That's the purpose, and that's what's missing. It has nothing to do with whether or not all Jews should serve in the Israeli army or not. All Jews should involve self-defense, obviously. To save a life, it takes precedence over Talmud Torah as well. But here, that's not the point that Rav Yosef is making. The point is that in terms of the purpose of our existence, the purpose of our existence is not Hatzalas Nefashos. That's necessary. That's not the purpose of our existence. The purpose of our existence is Talmud Torah. You know, it's widest context. Talmud Torah meaning the essential purpose of the Jew, ascertaining God's will and implementing it in our private lives, our communal lives, and globally as well. That's the purpose of Jewish life. That's why we exist. It's only meaningful that we exist if we present why we exist. And by the way, try this next time you're at a family party or a parlor meeting with some of these people who fight for Jewish existence. Why? Why is that important? Let's say no Jew existed. I don't want to mention any names, but I was once involved in discussion. It had to do with the gay race issues. And someone was, one of my colleagues, an older colleague, more liberal than I am, not hard to be, he said that he wants the broadest possible definition of Jewishness, all right? We're talking about adopted children. And he says, as far as he's concerned, if they send their children to a day school and they keep kosher at home, that's sufficient. We require shmiras mitzvos, because only a school is for a child to convert, to become a Jew, if he'll observe the mitzvos, not be put in a position where he'll violate the mitzvos. So I said to him, you mean it wouldn't bother you? It means nothing to you? If the two parents and the infant go from the mikveh to McDonald's to celebrate his Jewishness, that doesn't bother you at all? So he said to me, which in retrospect was a non sequitur, he said, I am not going to give up on the possibility that this child might discover the cure for cancer. So I'm thinking to myself, well, only Jews can discover cures for cancer? What does that mean? This is like a bizarre statement. But the bottom line is, here we have a demonstration of that idea. It's not enough just to be Jewish. You have to be Jewish for a reason. And it's the reason that we're Jewish that really should give the proper impetus to the desire to keep Jews alive. And that becomes the challenge of the generation. Indeed, that was the challenge, that was the failure in Shushan. In Shushan, the Jews were primarily assimilated. The tshuva that brought about the Yeshua, the salvation, was essentially the reclamation of our faith, the reclamation of the reason why we're Jewish as the foundation for the capacity for ourselves to be saved. We were saved only because of the tshuva. In other words, we could have been reconstituted in another form also. Haman could have succeeded in some limited form, but for the fact that we reclaimed our heritage. Without our heritage, it's not enough that we live and breathe and walk. It's really our life comes from the Torah, Kehem Chayenu, V'Orech Chameinu. And with that, I wish everyone a very happy Purim. Yeah.